Test. Am I on? I'm on? Welcome, everybody. Ooh, sorry, I shouldn't do that. I'd like to just get the elephant in the room out. Y'all are here saving a seat for the 2:30 session with Walter Brueggemann. And so I just want to say I hate you because of that, and that you're not really here for me, and that hurts my feelings. And so somebody's like, why are we, who is that guy up there? We're not here for him. We're saving seats because Walter Brueggemann will be here in a minute. Was anybody at that session yesterday with Walter Brueggemann? Yeah. I think Jan and I were sitting up here against that grate. So very comfortable. But it was amazing. Wasn't he amazing? And so it was awesome. So for those of you not here for me, my name is Richard Beck, and I am the chair of the psychology department at Abilene Christian University. And so welcome to this session. And Walter Brueggemann will be following me here shortly. So I would use the restroom halfway through my presentation. Don't leave your seats at the end because they won't be. I lectured a freshman. You can't offend me, ladies and gentlemen. You can fall asleep. You can walk off. You can watch movies in the back on Netflix. I have seen it all. I'm immune to whatever can happen in here. So anyway, welcome to this session. So it's entitled "Your Teacher Breaks Bread with Sinners." And so to just give some background here, this is going to be some material from a book I wrote called Unclean. And some of you have read that. Some of you might have heard me present on this. I'm going to try to bring in some new material this class and the next one. So some will be a retread. So I'm trying to not, when you present on a material repeatedly, I kind of get anxious about people hearing the same thing over and over. And so I've tried to, even if you've read Unclean, hopefully there'll be some new things in here. If you've not read it, then it's about, Unclean is a book about hospitality, but coming at it from a psychological perspective. And so, again, I'm a psychologist, and so you're going to get kind of some psychological stuff here. And so, to begin, so let's start with this. Let me start in a way I've never really started this material before, and it's with this study that I discovered after I wrote the book. And it's always that way, isn't it? Somebody said, I saw you wrote a book. Have you looked at this study? So a friendly reader of my blog sent me this study, and I would like to begin there because I think it illustrates the problem that I'm trying to unpack. And so I want to describe this study in some detail because I think it's a very profound way of recognizing what our struggles are when we're talking about welcoming. So when we see Jesus' kind of radical ministry of table fellowship, welcoming tax collectors and sinners, and we ask ourselves when people, you know, in the scriptures, your teacher, and as students, we don't listen to our teacher very often because I don't think the church is notorious for breaking bread with tax collectors and sinners. Why is that? Like, what's the hiccup there? Why can't, it seems very obvious what Jesus does. I mean, you can read those stories. Zacchaeus, you know, the woman caught in the act of adultery. I mean, seems fairly transparent and obvious, but yet we have trouble executing that. So why is that? I don't think it's not a lack of good preaching. It's not a lack of understanding. I think the problem is rooted deep in our affections. And so this, but deeper than that, kind of how, I'm going to show you some kind of neuroscientific data here. So let me unpack this. I know it's going to seem like a strange way to get there, but I think you'll find this interesting. So in this study, the researchers here, Harris and Fisk, what they were doing is looking at the way people, from a neuroimaging perspective, when they're processing social groups and the emotions associated with social groups, they were looking at kind of in-group and out-group members. And so they used a theory that suggested that we kind of identify social groups along two continuum. One is capability to help us. And so if we're ever in need, the degree that the person or the group is capable of responding to our needs. So people who are high capability are people that could help us if they so desired. Does that make sense? And people with low capability are people that might want to help us, but they just lack the ability to help us, okay? So this is capability to helping me, okay? Then warmth is the degree to which you feel that this group is sympathetic to you, okay? So you might have high warmth. They are sympathetic to you, but they lack capability. They'd like to help, but they can't. Or you might have a group that is highly capable of helping, like rich people. sorry to be mean to rich people here, but you know, so wealthy people, they might have the capability to help, but you know, they're off in their Malibu mansions, and so they're not likely to respond to my plight. So low warmth in that sense. And they were mainly assessing middle class people, and so that's the in group. Does that make sense? So middle class subjects responding to middle targets. So what they did is they had pictures of these various groups that they felt, we could disagree with this, but they felt kind of triggered different social emotions, okay? So the idea here is if the in-group here is middle-class persons, if I'm imagining pictures of people that look like me, my in-group, then that's going to be associated with feelings of pride, okay? So that's kind of like the in-group. The rest of everybody else is more like the out-group, okay? So, again, I made the comment about the rich person. So these are people that kind of have high capability or competence. They could help us, but, you know, they're wealthy people, and so they lack this connection to help me in my plight. So the feelings about that group, out-group member, would be envy or jealousy, okay, resentment about that group, okay? And then the elderly, they marked as people who would be highly warm, right? So elderly persons are very kind people stereotypically, you know, but because they're elderly, their ability to help us is somewhat diminished. And so we have feelings of maybe pity or sympathy towards them. But the group that is most important for the purposes of our time here and their research was a group that they felt stereotypically falls in this low capability, low warmth group. And so that they were showed pictures of people like sleeping on benches, homeless persons, or drug addicts. Okay, so these are people that we don't have because of their lack of virtue. If they're homeless or because of their addiction, they don't lack any impulse to help me. Low warmth, but they're also because of their addiction or their homelessness. Even if they wanted to help, you know, could not help me. And so the feelings that are triggered by that kind of group, it was argued, is contempt or relevant for unclean, the emotion of disgust, okay? And so the idea here is you would be shown pictures of all these different groups and we're watching brain activation in the frontal cortex where social cognition is activated. And social cognition is different from, so if I was asking you like to put a, if I was asking you to like try to navigate Malibu traffic, there'd be a part of your problem-solving brain that would activate, but part of your frontal cortex that regulates social cognition would not activate because it's an abstract, impersonal problem, like figuring out a puzzle. But trying to figure out like how to get your in-laws to where they should sit at Thanksgiving dinner, given you know the other in-laws that are coming, and oh my goodness, if they get together, you know those interpersonal puzzles, pastors, how you get all your elders to work together. That problem solving is a social cognition, and a different part of your brain lights up when you're doing people solving rather than puzzle solving, okay? So we're watching the brain light up here, watching these groups. In addition, and this will be relevant in a minute, they also showed objects in these locations because we're looking at social cognition versus abstract impersonal cognition. So they showed objects that would trigger the same feelings relevant to these groups. So under the rich person, they might show like a stack of money or a Mercedes. So you're looking at like rich people things. And for the elderly, you might look at a walker or something that signals the, you know, an elderly person. Middle class, I don't know what they did with that one. But relevant for our purposes, the objects for the homeless and the addicts was vomit and toilets. Okay, those are the objects that would elicit disgust, obviously, right? So, okay, so you guys got that? So people are looking at objects or people. They're supposed to trigger pride or envy or pity or disgust or contempt. And they did find that. They did find when people saw these groups, those emotions subjectively were endorsed. Like the people said, when those are the feelings. So they know they were triggering those feelings. But the question is, what's going on in the brain in relation to these feelings? And this is not the best but I think you can kind of see it. So this is the prefrontal cortex activated. This is the area of social cognition When you're looking at the three groups, in-group, which is pride, and then the out-group, envy, and the out-group, pity, and you see here for those groups, and those are the feelings they're experiencing, I don't know if you can kind of see the little red circle. Can you see it? That's the part of the brain that lights up when you're solving a social problem. Let me just gesture at it here or whatever like that. So y'all see that like circle there? You know, and so you see there in the frontal cortex, these are the eyes looking at you. That part of the brain is lit up. So when they're, even though they might be envious towards rich people, they're still processing them as human beings. Or even though they might be feeling pity upon an elderly person, they're still processing that elderly person as a human being. Relevant for our purposes today, this is when they were looking at homeless people or addicts across the top. And in the second study is when they're looking at vomit and toilets. And what do you notice it's missing? The little red circle's missing. The part of the brain that processes this is a human being is not activated. And it looks, the brain looks fairly similar to when people are looking at toilets or vomit. And so this is just kind of neuropsychological evidence to suggest that when people are seeing images of the homeless or somebody like an addict, they're not even seeing them as a human being. Functionally, they're seeing them as objects, equivalent to disgust, to vomit or a toilet. That the humanity of the person is not even registering in a brain scan. That's our problem. Why do we not welcome tax collectors and sinners? And the answer is behind me on the screen. There's a part of your brain that is not kicking in. And because it kicks in, it's not saying it has to be a positive feeling. Like I said, negative feelings like pity or envy toward the rich or the elderly, you know, it's not a positive emotionality thing. It's that some fundamental aspect of ourselves are not affectionately registering the humanity of the person in front of us. That's the challenge for the church. How do you get people to get that part of the brain to light up? And that's what this session's about. How about that for a hook? Right. Let me show you another way of looking at this. I did not talk about this research in Unclean, but many of you know it probably. How many of you are familiar with the implicit association test? Somebody familiar with it? You may know Malcolm Gladwell's Blink. He had a chapter on this. Some of you might have, but if you don't know the implicit association test, this started at Harvard. And what they did in this research, this is just another thing to illustrate our problem. Here is what they did in the early implicit association tests. It had to do with race. Okay, so this is mainly with Caucasians taking the test, looking at Caucasian and African American faces, and looking at kind of a version of what's called a Stroop effect, an interference effect. Y'all know what the Stroop effect is? Y'all need to take Introduction to Psychology at ACU at some point. The Stroop effect. Here's an interesting thing. This is, welcome to my lecture style. This is fairly random, but like, if you're going to argue, I'm a psychologist. So if you're like, what's the most famous psychologist in the history of the Churches of Christ? Dr. Stroop. Dr. Stroop taught at Lipscomb University. Any Lipscomb people here? Dr. Stroop, you guys know this. It's the famous effect where if I have color words, but I print them, if it's the word red, but I have it in green, and I make you try to read the names of the words, there's an interference effect where the part of my brain, one is processing the word, but then the color is activating another part, and it causes this hesitation. That interference effect is called the Stroop effect. And Dr. Stroop published his doctoral dissertation in that, and as best I can tell, like, left the world of psychology. He went and taught Bible at Lipscomb and wrote Bible study books or whatever, but like, that effect has become, like a couple years ago, was recognized as the most single-sided psychological phenomenon in the history of psychology. That cognitive, because, and the implicit association is built right on top of it. He's a Church of Christ guy. I remember my first year, I taught 1 year at Lipscomb, and does anybody know Bob Sturgeon? Bob Sturgeon was the chair at the time, and he said, hey, come here, let me show you something. And he goes into some random closet at Lipscomb, and he pulls out, like, old-looking Stroop cards. And he said, you know what these are? I said, no. Because these are the original Stroop cards from, like, his doctoral dissertation. They're, like, in a closet. I'm like, these should be in the Smithsonian. Like, why are they in this random closet at Lipscomb University? There's this, I didn't steal any of the Stroop cards. I should have when I left. I should have said, like, where'd the Stroop cards go? I don't know. They're in an exhibit at Abilene Christian University. We have no idea how they got there, but anyway, they were donated. Anyway, I don't know. There's your random psychological Church of Christ history today. Dr. Stroop, most famous psychologist in the Churches of Christ. Anyway, the Stroop effect in this test is a little different. What you're asked to do in this test is the first thing you're asked to do before this comes up, before this trial comes up, you're asked to just sort good and bad words. So on the right hand, let's say, is good words, and the left hand is bad words. So the word beautiful comes up. What do you do? That's a good word. The word ugly comes up. That's a bad word. So you're just sorting. That's good. That's bad. You can make mistakes, but you're trying to go as fast as you can. Sort, sort, sort. And you practice it, and they flip it around. They change it on the hands. They do all the counterbalancing. So you're just practicing this. And then comes up a facial categorization task. And so what they do is they just give you this little picture right there of a face, and you're asked to categorize the face. Is that Caucasian or is that African-American? So these faces are popping up. You're quickly trying to discriminate the race of the person, you know? So African-American on this hand, Caucasian on this hand, you're sorting the faces really quickly, okay? And so you practice both of those. Word association, good and bad, faces, African-American, Caucasian, quickly as you can, quickly as you can. And then, in the most important trials of the test, you're doing a dual sorting. So a word might come up, and you got to sort it like you've been doing it, good or bad. And a face will come up in the middle of all that randomly, and you've got to sort the face, black or white, really quick. And what the implicit association test has found is that when, this is actually the reverse, but when you get African-American and bad on the same hand, like that's on my right side, right, let's say, and I get white and good on my left hand, and those line up, we go faster. When I cross them, like behind me, a Stroop effect kind of sets in. And it's just a little bad is on my right. No, that's a black face. And does it make sense? There's an interference task. When we get the valence, white is good, black is bad, on the same side, less interference. Now, that is not an explicit racial assumption. That's why it's called the implicit association test. This is not anything rationally, like you could take a racism test before you do that, but yet this will still pick up this little hesitancy, even among African Americans, that they've imbibed. They struggle themselves with the white is good and the black is bad. You know what I mean? So even they themselves can show, because of the white dominant culture, they can internalize that as well. Now, they then went on, and by the way, you can take this test online. I don't recommend it unless you have strong ego strength. It's not going to come out well. I'm just saying. I'm just saying. Like students at mine that don't show the association, you know, or often students have been raised abroad or raised in very, you know, they come from racially mixed marriage. I mean, they just, you know, but most people will show the implicit association, this instinctive appraisal that you might say that that's a depressing finding, and it is, but I think it's important to just kind of recognize that. That's kind of, you have to begin there. You have to begin with this recognition that I'm struggling against a bias in my gut. The scariest people in the world are people like that say I'm not a racist. Well, okay, you're probably a racist if you say that. You know, I mean, just like most self-aware people will not be quick to say that. You know, so if you ask me, are you a racist, Richard Beck? I would go probably. At some gut level, I cannot unequivocally say I don't know, because I'm a psychologist. And that skepticism about your own virtue, I think, is one of the most healthy things you can cultivate. That's not really my point today, but skepticism about your own virtue is probably one of the most healthy things you can contemplate. But here's my point. Let me keep going. When am I supposed to be done? 2:30. Okay. Is that right? 2:15. Great. All right. Moving along. Right. When Walter Brueggemann walks in the door, we know we should wrap this up. Anyway. they've gone on and done this not just with race, but just about every other relevant in-group, out-group distinction. Gay, straight, Christian, Muslim, Apple, PC, skinny, fat. They've looked at it. And almost any relevant distinction that we kind of sort our world into, they show these biases that are implicit in just about all of us. This hesitancy to see out-group members as fully human beings, right? And so in my book, I talk about a process called those who've read the book, infrahumanization, where we kind of have a slight hesitancy to attribute full human status to out-group members. And you know this, right? I mean, you dehumanize all the time, don't you? sure, yes, I do. I mean, think about it. I ask my students about this. I say, think about the people that voted against you in the last election, right, whatever your party is. Like, isn't there something wrong with those people? Like, in your gut, aren't you fundamentally convinced that there's something broken in them? Because, right, think about it. If they were smart enough, they would change their minds, right? Or if they were good enough, they were good human beings. So the stereotypes, the implicit stereotypes we have, you know? So Democrats are bad people. They're bad people because they don't care about the unborn. They're literally wicked people. And Republicans are bad people. They are literally wicked people because they don't care about the poor. You know what I'm saying? That's this gut instinct that we have of the fundamental wickedness that infects out-group members. And that's our struggle. Why don't we break bread with tax collectors and sinners? And because there is this hitch in our heart, a psychological hesitancy in our heart. I don't have a lot of time to talk about purity here, but this is really kind of what unclean is about, the emotion of disgust and the way it plays out amongst us. I begin my book with, some of you guys know the book, I begin it with the Dixie Cup experiment by Paul Rosen. How many, has anybody read Unclean? You guys know this story. Somebody was telling me they tried to teach this in their church and they drank the spit. And then they said it didn't go well. And I was like, well, that's something you shouldn't do. But for those of you that, that know the book is if you swallow spit in your mouth, it's not a problem, right? If you swallow spit in your mouth, but if you spit it into a cup and are asked to re-drink it, it's problematic. And the answer is, for those who read the book, why is that? What's the physical difference between swallowing the spit in your mouth quickly and then re-drink it? You shouldn't re-drink it. You should just contemplate re-drinking it. And I never have college males do this demo because they will drink it. Like college males. As best I can tell is if you get a man in front of a crowd, they'll do any crazy thing. Like, so you can't trust a man. You need women. They're sane, and they won't do stupid stuff like that. You get a college male to say, would you drink it? He'll do it. You know. So my point is that disgust is a boundary psychology. The difference is when something leaves the boundary of the self, it's foreign, it's alien. And so that kind of goes back to the idea of the homeless and the addicts. They are somehow on the outer boundary of humanity here. And disgust triggers that. Now, some of you guys might say, well, I don't really feel disgusted by certain people. But the book also talks about how contempt and superiority is often a version of disgust hierarchically expressed. Darwin was the first to realize this, that wrinkling of the nose in disgust is the same sneer of superiority that we have. So they're very similar emotions. And so if you don't feel disgusted by people, we often do struggle with feelings of superiority, feeling better than other groups of people. So obviously, if disgust is operative, we are externalizing people and seeing them as not a part of the in-group. And I also go on to talk about contamination appraisals in the book as well. Disgust in Latin means to taste bad, but not everything that tastes bad is disgusting. And so there's more to it. And usually what has to happen is some attribution of something as being a foul or toxic or contaminating. And those judgments, what psychologists would call attributions, are governed by kind of laws of cause and effect about what causes contamination occur. Psychologists would call forms of what are called magical thinking. They're not necessarily, they don't obey the laws of physics, but they're theories about cause and effect that seem to defy it. And many of these appraisals make sense in the realm of food, but when applied to human beings, they create, again, these psychological problems in welcoming other people, like proximity. So obviously if there's a bug that's close to or scampers across your pasta, right? If there's contact or proximity, my apologies. I should have put a warning on this, like for the faint of heart, don't come in here. But in the realm of food, that makes sense. If a contaminant is touching or close to your food, you'd worry about that, right? But when applied to human beings, if human beings are considered to be vectors of contamination, moral contamination, you know, so this is where you get to the problem where people literally cannot be in the company of another human being, like literally cannot be close to a gay person, would fear that somehow that will rub off on them. And we reason about morality as almost as like a physical virus that can be transferred. So you guys will recall in the book, talk about Paul Rosen's study about he tells subjects that there's a sweater. Here's this sweater. You guys remember this in the book? There's a sweater, and it was worn by Hitler. And he asked people if they would put it on. And most people were like, you know, like, no, it's just a sweater. Just wash it. It's good to go, you know. He hardly ever wore it, you know. It's just a piece of clothing, right? And you're like, no, it's not a piece of clothing. We actually feel that some of this evilness seeps into it and stains it, in that no amount of washing or cleansing can get rid of it. So literally, that's why we get these, we think of people being icky, and we play contagion games on the playground, right? Where kids have cooties, and we play these. We reason about human beings in the idiom of contamination, and that causes us not to back away from people. And I'm saying this is not happening in any rational way. It's magical thinking. This isn't a gut instinct appraisal. And that's Jesus' problem. Why are you eating with tax collectors? Why are you in proximity to them? And so obviously a church that is going, when its mind and its heart is governed by this kind of logic, proximity with sinners is inherently unintuitive. It doesn't make any sense because of the ickiness that can rub off on the church. So a church that has trouble just even maintaining proximity with sinners. I'm not even saying you have to be nice. Just proximity is problematic. And psychologists have done studies. If somebody is told that a gay person slept in their hotel bed, they're much less likely to sleep in it if they were the night before. I mean, and these are emotional ways of reasoning about the world, okay? Similarity, this is going to get worse. This is going to get worse. So like with my students, I'll put a bedpan, a clean bedpan, and we'll pour lemonade in it. And we'll ask if they would drink it. And they know it's lemonade, and they know it's a clean bedpan. But they're like, no, I'm not going to drink it. Again, a guy would, but let's not talk about that, you know, normal people we're speaking about. Paul Rosen, that's a Paul Rosen study. He baked brownies that look like feces, asked people to eat it. And again, even though you know it's a brownie, it's like, no. But again, there's something, even though we know what I mean, that sounds crazy, but here's what I'm trying to say. This is why that study's powerful, although silly. Is it shows you that even if you know better, the gut rules. Does it make sense? This is why it's so hard for preachers. The problem isn't getting you to know better. You know, there isn't probably, I can teach you the stories, but the gut rules. That's our problem. This affectional problem is somewhere is broken. You know it. I know that that is lemonade. I know it rationally. But I'm not going to do it. There's a gut instinct. And that's, I think, where our problems have come in. Last one, negativity dominance. This is the worst illustration of them all. But like some of you guys have seen me do this online with my students. I'll get an apple and feces. I tell them it's feces. It's a Tootsie Roll. But they're told it's feces. And I put the two together. And I ask them to eat the apple. and they won't do it. Even the guys won't do it. So there's a limit. There is a limit, apparently. It's pretty far down the line, but that's a limit. And I said, why won't you eat the apple? And they say, because it touched the contaminant. And then I said, well, then would you eat the feces? Because surely the deliciousness of the apple would have rubbed off on the feces. And they're like, no, it doesn't work that way. And these are ACU students, so these are our best and brightest, ladies and gentlemen. So they can figure that one out on the test. I can't trick them into that. Psychologists call that negativity dominance, where in the moment of contact between the pure and the polluted, the negative dominates over the positive. That's just the way we reason about it. Okay, but here's my point. I think, to me, in many ways, that is the metaphor behind it all. That's the intuitive way we think about contagion. And if that is the emotional gut reaction of the church, then when the church and the world, the church and the sinner, comes into contact, and we're reasoning about human beings as contagions, the instinct is contact contaminates the church. It contaminates. It doesn't dawn on the Pharisees when Jesus is eating with sinners that, I mean, they're making a very intuitive emotional judgment. Jesus is with them. He's unclean now. Negativity dominance. It's very unintuitive to flip this. It's irrational, but all the way through the Gospels, Jesus is reversing the polarity of contagion. He becomes like a positive contamination. So the woman with the unclean blood disease, you know, touches Jesus and she is purified. I think that's the struggle. This is an emotional reversal that is very counterintuitive, and the churches just are not going to naturally see it this way or feel it this way. So this is one more example of the psychological. So I've talked about neuroscience data. I've talked about the implicit association test and a little bit from unclean on purity psychology, how at some deep affectional level things are amiss and they're broken. And so the question is, what are the triggers that you have? What are your buttons that get pushed? Everybody has buttons, you know? Maybe gay people don't push your buttons, you know? Maybe that's not a trigger for you. But, but somebody voting for Barack Obama is your trigger. Maybe that's your trigger. Or somebody that, like, voted for, you know, Sarah Palin. That's your trigger. Or so politics, that's one of our biggest triggers, I think. The dehumanizing, the affective dehumanization of in our political discourse. That's the saddest thing about all of that. When I look at that. Certain habits. What are habit triggers? Like, how do you feel about smokers? You know, if you're gonna start trying to reach out to the margins, you're gonna run into smokers. You know, they're going to be smoking outside your church, too. But if that's a trigger for you, then some of you, that is like a trigger. It's like that's a, quote-unquote, a disgusting habit, right? And if it's not a disgust trigger, the smell of smoke or the smoker, it's a contempt. They're stupid. Don't you know those will kill you? You know what I'm saying? All of those are affective ways we begin dehumanizing other people. They're not just, but those of you guys that live out on the margins, you know, am I right? You're going to be with smokers, you know? You have to get over that trigger, you know. That's how small a thing could be a problem, to welcome one smoker into your midst, you know. To smell the smoke, you know, and we're worried about our kids and secondhand smoke, but one person comes in smelling like smoke, you know. And that's a trigger for me. Like when I drive friends from Freedom Fellowship where I worship, where we reach out to the poor and homeless, you know, and I crank those windows down because all my friends are smokers, and I just don't like the smell. But I got to deal with that. I got to master that. That's one of my things that's a trigger for me. And those immediate, quick, implicit appraisals you make as you exit the church door and you see somebody smoking. To me, that's a big one. I've noticed that is a big one in my life, in the churches I go to. Ethnicity, we've already talked about. Hygiene. If you're out on the margins, hygiene is going to be a trigger, particularly in West Texas in the summertime. A lot of our friends can't get to showers fairly regularly, and there are some summer nights when we walk into Freedom, and you know, a certain friend of yours has just not been able to get to a shower. That'll knock out half a room. You know, literally, you can walk in like, why is everybody sitting on the left side? Oh, okay, I'm olfactorily aware now about what's going on. But it takes self-mastery to put yourself in the middle of that and master it and sit there next to somebody who you feel like their hygiene isn't up to snuff or whatever. Another trigger for me is I have little OCD issues. And see, that's the thing, is if you're trying to be a hospitable person on the margins and you have OCD, you're fairly well screwed, as best I can tell. I'm serious, you know. I mean, you're going to get messy. And like, I'll give you one example. I'm driving some friends home, and they're like, you know what? They're spraying our house today. Why is that? Oh, we got bed bugs. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you all got bed bugs, and you're in my car. And I'm like, all of a sudden I get the heebie-jeebies, and I'm like, but we're doing it. And that's silly, but I'm serious. If those of you guys that have been doing this kind of work, you know you're going to get contaminated in certain ways, you know. There's no way to kind of have this kind of quarantine, you know, that you try to wreck. A sensory quarantine, a moral quarantine. It's going to get messy in many kinds of ways. You're going to literally be pressing the flesh with people that have bed bugs and have hygiene issues and things like that. And that's why it's so hard to make a hospitable church. Our people are well-intentioned and kind and good people. But the gut has not been formed in a way that allows them to lean into the discomfort. You get my point? This is kind of my... And by the way, I'm not going to clean this up for you. You have to come back tomorrow. I'm trying to give you a vision from a psychological perspective. Why are churches not welcoming? This is my explanation. You know, it's not because we're bad people. It's just because we have these triggers. Sins we've talked about, from same-sex marriage and to other kinds of sins, criminal history. You're going to be dealing with people with all sorts of kind of criminal history. You know, I made a joke to Jan the other day. We walked out of our church, and there was a guy, police officer there to pick somebody up inside. And I told Janet, well, you haven't really been at church when the police are waiting outside to arrest somebody in the congregation. That's church. Fairly motley crew with a mixed and checkered legal history, apparently. But that's criminal history. You know, you're dealing with people who have been in and out of jail a great kind of deal. Dress is a trigger, you know, is it not? And this goes multiple ways. But there are certain kinds of looks that look ghetto to some kind of people, looks, you know, thug-like, and there's all these. So that might be your trigger, that kind of urban, you know, that urban look. Or it could just be a poverty kind of issue. Sexual orientation, socioeconomic class, religion. We talked about Christian attitudes about Muslims, just personal history. And what I meant by personal history is, You all have personal histories with people like in your churches, right? I mean, there are some people that trigger these basically because you have history with them. Something happened 3 years ago, and you have not forgotten it. So sometimes it's not any big deal. It's just you have personal history with that person, or you know of something they did to a friend of yours. And so we quarantine in the church, you know, around people that we have histories with. Social ineptness. Lots of people trigger us because they're just socially inept. They're just socially awkward or broken, or they're loud, or they're boastful, you know, or they're uncouth. And that's just hard to deal with, that degree of social ineptness. We have a friend that tells just chronic lies constantly, you know. It's just to listen to. And it's not just... It's not, is Becky Almanza laughing back there? Becky Almanza knows what I'm talking about. But this one of our friends of ours told us this story once. He goes, hey, he's a fairly poor guy. He says, I golfed 36 holes of golf yesterday. I'm like, I can't even afford 18 holes of golf. You got. And he goes, you wouldn't believe what happened. What happened? He goes, I killed a deer. I hit it with a golf ball. I was like that's the kind of thing. And you're like, really? That's the story he told me. You know, and you just, and it's, but here's it. But it's a person that doesn't have a lot to, you know. I mean, if I talk to one of my ACU friends, we could talk about all these. You know, what do you say to make somebody lean in and go, I guess that's what you do. Right? You go for broke right there. You know. But those, I have another. I drive the van for Freedom sometimes, and when I started off, I didn't know the route. I didn't know the route. I didn't know where to pick everybody up, and I. But this one friend would just be in my ear, just go, you know, go, turn left, turn right. And early on, I needed it, but you know, after a while, that kind of aggressive, you know, dominant, you know, kind of thing, you know, and like a year in, I'm being told, turn right, turn left, you know? And I'm like, this is what I want to say. I was like, I have a PhD. Yeah. I know how to drive a van, you know, and I know where I'm going. So y'all just shut up and let me drive the van. And, And I admit, this is the perverse thing at me. Like, I know I should turn right, but I'll go straight, you know? And I'll go straight. And they'd be like, hey, why don't you turn? You're supposed to go right, then left, and we'll get there. I go, but you could go straight and then take a right, and I think we will get, it's a square. I can go this way, you go that way, we'll get there, you know? They're like, well, okay, should have gone right, though. And I was like, but that kind of rigid. But here's my thing, is like, but they just, you guys don't have those kinds of problems, right? You just let me drive the van. You'd sit quietly and go, he cannot drive, this guy cannot drive. But you would not do that. You have social skills is what I'm trying to say, but lots of people don't have social skills. You guys, you know that kind of thing. They just can't read verbal cues. They talk too close, and you're like, I don't like talking to them. And or people that don't notice you're leaving, that's the thing that gets me. That's my trigger. It's like, I'm literally walking away from you, and you're still talking to me. Like, I'm sending you every nonverbal signal. Yeah, yeah, gotta, yeah, and they're just following you, and you're like halfway out the door. You're like, I am exiting, the door's open, I'm leaving. You're like, am I right? You're like, I can't, and I'm being funny, kinda, but what I'm saying is, you guys know, like, you think about your church, right? Conjure up your church, conjure up your place of work. There's just people that are socially, that are struggle, right? And so we lean away. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about one of my favorite Catholic saints, Saint Therese of Lisieux, and her little way of hospitality. That's a teaser for tomorrow. But one of my favorite, she lived in a convent, you know, and she talks about this, social ineptness. And she talks about how... living with the sisters, you know, there's these socially damaged sisters, that these people I'm talking about in your, and how we take, she says, we take long detours around them. Haven't you not done that? How many of you, let's confess right now, have taken a detour around somebody at church? Like, you see them coming, and you go, oh, got to go to the restroom right here. Like, right? We detour around people. And what she says is, and when we do that, she calls it a form of, like, persecution. We basically begin quarantining ourselves off. And so these lonely people, these socially broken people, become very lonely, needy. And it exacerbates sometimes their anxiety and panic. And so even though I'm kind of being silly here, and even in my joking, that's kind of demeaning in many ways, and I apologize. But I am trying to kind of pull you into this a little bit, put you on the hook, like I do this kind of thing, these effective kinds of things. So obviously these are the texts, right? Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? In a chapter on down, Jesus is called to be, he's a friend of tax collectors and sinners, right? And boy, wouldn't it be great, like if I had a dream for the church, that would be the dream. Like if the church of Jesus Christ, the friend of tax collectors and sinners. Boy, how far off is that? If we want to be Christians, then we should earn the label friend of tax collectors and sinners. That's our teaching, right? Why does our teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? And the reason why I don't think we do that is because, again, hospitality and welcome is an emotional capacity that we are lacking in many ways. We're not, our gut, our hearts are broken in many ways. They're disordered. And so as we go through life, we end up persecuting people because we detour around them, or they hit some sort of trigger of ours and we dehumanize them. And on it goes. And so what we need to cultivate is what Miroslav Volf calls the will to embrace. In Mark 1, a leper comes to Jesus and says, "Will you make me clean?" Let me end with this. To me, this is the gospel in microcosm. The leper comes to Jesus and says, "Will you make me clean?" And Jesus reaches out and touches him first. And then says, and I think the ordering is everything here. And then says, it literally enters into uncleanliness with him. And then says, "Be clean." Because I think if you reverse that, it's a different story. Be clean. Get married, give me a hug, you know. No bed bugs. You know, it's you are embraced in your uncleanliness. That will to embrace is primary. And lots of people ask me, "Well, what about sin? What about sin? What about sin?" We'll maybe get there, you know. But let's get the will to embrace first, because otherwise the conversation about sin, it will be dehumanizing. And I think that's the trouble with the church. We get this order out of whack here. So how do we do this? How do you cultivate and rework your affections? That's going to be tomorrow at 1:30. The Walter Brueggemann crowd is coming in. Again, I told you to go to the bathroom earlier, and you did not take my advice. So now, try to claim that bench, ladies and gentlemen. Just have your husband or wife just lay down. Just claim it. I'll see you tomorrow.